So we're all set and ready to go.
Yeah.
Yes, has Tim got his script this week?
Straight into it without abusing each other, then.
I about to say, well, has Tim got his script, but you know.
It's a Monday, you know.
This isn't the BBC Light programme.
The Tony Hancock Appreciation Society presents, ooh, very nearly an armful, a Tony Hancock podcast.
Hello and welcome to Very Nearly an Armful, brought to you by the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society.
On the podcast, we'll be discussing Tony's famous series, Hancock's Half Hour.
We'll discuss the show, its production, and what we liked about it.
We rate or review the episode and just generally get our geek on about vintage comedy.
We're your hosts. I'm James Griffith.
I'm Martin Gibbons.
I'm John Street.
And I'm Tim Elms.
And we're spread across the south of the UK in a line from Wiltshire to Essex via Kent.
And our members are spread all over the world. We have members in Hadley, Rayleigh, Chudley and Cranley.
That's a lot of lays. And in this podcast, we'll be discussing Fred's Pie Stall, the seventh episode of the sixth and final radio series. And this is Tim's personal favourite. It was recorded on Wednesday the 17th of June and then broadcast on Tuesday the 10th of November 1959.
But first of all, chaps, how is everyone doing?
Not too bad, not too bad. I got hold of a film the other day I've not seen since the days of VHS called Ooh, You Are Awful, But I Like You.
Oh, the Dick Emery film.
Dick Emery, you know. Oh, hello, honky tonk. And all of that. But I must say, the DVD was probably from a sort of beta cam master, because there was obviously indications of a video source of some description rather than being a nice new transfer.
Can I just ask you to hold on a second, guys? I've just realised I haven't done something I should have done.
I thought it was going very well.
I thought it was too smooth, yeah.
We can hear the cogs ticking, can't we?
Yep.
Cogs clicking at Tim's end.
It's the expressions as he looks at things and presses the buttons that's... it's like Hancock trying to read, you know, Bertie Russell, isn't it?
Got it.
You're all good?
Right. Yeah, I didn't have my headphones on correctly, so I wondered why the noise was strange.
I had
my headphones on, but I was listening through the speaker.
Oh, well, there's all good.
The dear defenders.
So yeah, Dick Emery, he's a very, very entertaining comedian and stuff, but I must say I don't think the film stood up quite as well as when I remember it from, you know, when I was 12 or something.
I put it on the back, he said. His back. I'll lay you 6-4, that's what he meant. It's tattooed on his back.
He had a lovely body.
Yeah, I'm going to get over that once with water a bit sharpish. Claim that lovely body, bring it back here for a quick shifty.
You stupid git, come back here, I'll put one on you.
Oh, hello, dear, did you see that? Some of them want knotting, don't they? I am allowed 20 minutes for loading.
Well, isn't it, because I haven't seen it for years, but isn't it sort of a recreation, really, of his television characters?
Essentially,
with a very loose story around it, but it is a very loose story.
He's a bank robber whose companion bank robber was old Thingamy Bob, who played the mayor in The Punch and Judy Man. Ronald Fraser. And Ronald Fraser dies, but he had the proceeds from their robbery. He had tattooed on four different ladies' bottoms the account number that it's held in. So he has to play, Dick Emery has to play various of his, you know, characters, be it the old sort of vicar with the big teeth, he's sort of Babs Blonde character and various others to try and view these tattoos and get the account number.
That was right.
Long, quite fun. And the Mafia are trying to look after him, make sure he doesn't get killed by some London gangster, because it's the Mafia's money that are stolen. They're following him to try and find the way to the money. Bit of fun, though.
Story as old as time.
Yeah.
Indeed.
One of the classics.
I've been watching something completely new. I'm watching the latest series of Ghosts. I don't know if any of you followed the earlier series of that. It's a very good modern comedy, and sadly, I believe, the last series, I think there might be a Christmas special coming up this year, but I think that will be the end. But like 40 Towers, going out on a high is probably the right thing to do. It's been a really good ensemble piece.
Life's about to change.
Just harmless bit of fun.
Is it, Patrick? Is it?
You put a claim in for a fire at your guest house.
Our claim is being investigated. How can we have all this land and nothing to sell?
Money, money, money.
Abba.
Ta-da! Thank you, thank you.
There is button to win one of us.
Going out with a bang.
I'm going to be sick.
There's only so far you can take certain characters, I suppose. I mean, it's quite a good, fun, family-friendly comedy, I'd say, because the people who make that are the people who used to make Horrible Histories, which is obviously more, you know, children-oriented, but fun for the adults too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I've watched a couple of series of that. I shall have to, at some point, get around to watching it.
One thing I've been doing is not so much watching TV as listening to the radio. And something that I found on BBC Sounds was a programme that was made for Radio 4 Extra. I think it started during the lockdown, but it's called What's Funny About? I don't know whether any of you have picked up on this. I certainly hadn't heard it before. In fact, it was my wife who told me about it. Helen said to me about it one day, and she's not a vintage comedy fan. She's not particularly any comedy fan, but she's a Radio 4 person and listens to Radio 4 and Radio 4 Extra a lot. And she heard one of these and recommended it to me. And basically, it's a series with Peter Fincham, who was a BBC producer and former controller of BBC One, and John Plowman, who was also a producer and he was former head of comedy. And they interview different people about various sitcoms over the years. And so they talk to John Lloyd and Tony Robinson, for example, about Blackadder. There's one with John Cleese on Fawlty Towers. There's another with Felicity Kendall, Girl of My Dreams on The Good Life, Dawn French on The Vicar of Dibley, and one for James here, David Renwick and Richard Wilson did one on One Foot in the Grove.
And, well, that's very interesting.
It's a terrific series, and I think they're about half an hour each, and the first question they ask the guests is, what's funny about? And they try to sort out what's funny about it. But basically, it's a bit like a podcast, really, sort of thing that we do when they're talking to guys and playing clips from the shows. How did it all start and what people like and all that sort of thing. So it's really interesting. And there was two series of this. Yeah.
And what's that called again, Tim? Sorry?
It's called What's Funny About?
Oh, right. Okay, cool.
There's two, I think it's either two or three series. They're all on BBC Sounds at the moment. As I said, they date back from about 2020, I think. And they're really good. In the Tony Robinson and John Lloyd one on Blackadder, they do make reference to Hancock. And I'm sure John will want to put a clip in here.
All you focused on was the word, you know.
But your character changed more than anybody else's.
I think I'm right in saying that was Ben's idea more than anyone else's. I mean, what Ben has always said to me was that what he felt was wrong with the first series essentially was that there was no dynamic, that if you look at something like Hancock's Half Hour, you've got someone who's thwarted in their room, surrounded by complete prats, and he bursts out in order to prove to the Pratts what a wonderful person he is. And the idea was that if Percy and Baldrick were really, really stupid and that Blackadder was the strutting cock in that room and he could then go in to see the Queen believing that he would be wonderful and then he gets thwarted, that would be a good energy for the series.
What about yourself, young James? Have you been up to anything other than recovering from your cold?
Slightly ill, but I did manage to binge watch a few things which I've been meaning to view for the last couple of months. I think there's something on Netflix, it's quite modern, it's not really in this genre at all, but it's called Downfall of the House of Usher on Netflix, which is almost like a horror thriller kind of whodunit kind of thing. It's really, really good. I would highly recommend it. There's a good cast in there. It's about 10 episodes, I think. It's really, really good. Have you known that House on Haunted Hill? I think it's the same writers of that, I think. It's good. It's got lots of good twists in it. And yeah, it's really, really good. I can recommend.
Your Honor, no matter how much evidence stacked against them, the Usher crime family stands stronger and darker than ever before.
anyone comes after us, we will exhaust our arsenal until the threat's neutralized.
By neutralized, do you mean sued into oblivion on the streets?
Neutralized. Like dead.
You guys, we really should get together more often. It's just a balm for the soul.
Roderick Usher. Your family is a collection of stunted hearts. Whose time has come?
Is it loosely based on Edgar Allan Poe, or just the title that sort of pinched for him?
I think it's just it might be. I don't know. I'm not that familiar with that. Apologies.
I just remember all the Vincent Price films from the 60s, 70s, really, rather than the novels. So they were probably fairly loose themselves.
I would recommend it. It's really, really good. It almost feels like it's you can kind of. It's always got a little bit of a Succession vibe about it, but there's a bit more gore. Well, a lot more gore. There's less.
Nothing like a bit of gore.
Yeah.
You know, when they have the warning, you know, gore, sex, violence and swearing, I think sounds ideal.
But that's about it.
And they do warn you about everything these days. So
they do tend to.
The list of the warning can get really quite lengthy these days, can't it?
Yes, it displays attitudes that are not concurrent with modern times, etc. is something that's often referred to. But
it's quite a regular one, yes, indeed.
And on old repeats. Have we got any Hancock headlines that you want to talk over, Martin?
Well, I think there's a very important Hancock headline that we should mention on this podcast.
Just a little.
just a small one. For listeners who aren't aware, Richard Harrison of the Radio Circle has done it again. And has found another lost Hancock's Half Hour episode. This one's called A Visit to Swansea. It's the fourth episode of the second radio series and features Harry Secombe alongside Tony. So Tony had a bit of a breakdown on his theatre tour and had, at the beginning of the second radio series, had hopped over to Italy. At very, very short notice, Harry Secombe stood in for him. And in this fourth episode of the series, Tony is back and the cast persuade him to go and say thank you to Harry, who is down a coal mine in Wales. So this is a fantastic find. We've not got any of the other episodes which saw Harry in the starring role. And this is going to be fantastic to hear how Harry takes on the part within this episode. It's, at the moment, we understand, being restored. And we are fingers crossed there will be a transmission date on Radio 4 Extra, I presume. But nothing's confirmed on that at the moment. So watch this space. We're all itching to hear it. And I've no doubt we will have a very nearly an armful podcast special when finally is available for us to listen to.
It does give you a lot of hope, doesn't it? There's going to be a few more come out of the woodworks. Because I don't know, you guys are far more in the know than me, but it did seem like that came out of the blue. Like, it just sort of popped up on Twitter.
Richard has got a big collection of tapes, and he collects tapes that he finds at boot fairs and on eBay and all sorts of places. And apparently he's got a room that's sort of piled high with tapes, and he gradually goes through them. From what I understand, this one came from the same batch as the Marriage Bureau, which was found some months ago. But tantalizingly, there are also other tapes in the same batch that he hasn't listened to yet. Who knows? It might just be some good old music from back in the day, but there might be another episode. But what it does demonstrate, as we've said on this podcast over and over again, is that, you know, I'm pretty sure that there are more programs out there. Mm-hmm. People used to record them on reel-to-reel tapes. Those tapes end up in people's lofts and garages. They sit there for many years. They are there, in my opinion, waiting to be found. And you know, if not from Richard, I'm sure we'll get some more. Some people always say, you won't find any more now. You know, too many years have passed. But this sort of throws that argument out the window.
You never know. I mean, even television, although obviously home recording of television wasn't really feasible or possible in the 1950s and 60s, up until the 70s, really. Well, no, in the 60s there were some, but they were open reel, you know, videotape, much like a reel-to-reel player. But audio recording was feasible for those that could afford it. I think they used to be the price of a small car by comparison back in the day. But, you know, there was a Hugh and I and an episode of Sykes black and white series that was discovered and announced recently, I think, on Twitter as part of something or the other. I can't remember. I think it was Missing Belief Wiped. But, you know, things reappear, and it's just always a wonderful surprise when they do. And I'm looking forward to hearing Harry Secombe's, only a small bit of Harry Secombe, his cameo at the end of the episode, but that will be a great addition to the archives, won't it?
Well, yeah, certainly will. And of course, we've got these two from Richard, and you talk about recording on from the television. We had The Italian Maid and the horror serial from about, that was found on eBay around about 2017. And they were really good quality audio recordings of television soundtracks. Yeah. And go back to the early 2000s, about 2004, 2005, there was the recordings of The Blackboard Jungle and the original version of The New Secretary rather than the Transcription Service remake. So there have been quite a few found. And for those who have purchased the Hancock's Half Hour Collectibles CDs, you'll find on there, I think, about 8 episodes that are either of higher quality or are of original length, not later edits, that Ted Kendall had acquired from Reel to Reels that he'd picked up from, much the same as Richard, from, I would imagine, boot fairs, eBay, and auction houses. So there's been a huge amount found in the last 20, 25 years. Let's keep fingers crossed there's more.
Exactly.
Fingers crossed that Richard has got more in this little box of his, but there we go. We'll have to wait and see.
Why do you think it is that there's some, you know, it feels like they're all been discovered now, but since we've been doing this podcast, they've discovered two. Why do you think it is that they are suddenly comes out? Is it just because stuff has been recovered and stuff are looking through, stuff's been bought and sold, and perhaps people have sadly passed on and left a lot of...
I think that's exactly it. I think it's a generational thing. And the generation who did this taping are the generation that are sadly passing on around this time or in recent years. I mean, when you think about it, so this would have been a reel-to-reel tape in the late 1950s.
Sure.
Say someone was, I don't know, say they were 30 at the time making these tapes, you know.
Yeah.
It's that sort of time when people are coming across these in the lofts and garages of deceased relatives. I mean, it's terribly sad, but it seems to me that's probably the case. I'm sure it's not the case for all of them.
I imagine it's also a case, isn't it, of, you know, someone who recorded this 50 years ago doesn't necessarily remember they recorded it or wouldn't think of it as something of value. But, you know, when it's passed on because they sell granny stuff that was hidden in the attic or whatever, other people will, like geeky guys like you and I, will go through them and see what's on them.
But, of course, this one was 1955.
Yes.
So we're approaching 70 years old.
Yeah.
So it's more than 50. It's almost a 70-year-old recording, and it's the only copy of this show that exists, and it's just incredible that it's still in a condition that is going to be, well, we understand is in a good condition. If Radio 4 Extra might consider broadcasting it, then it must be a fairly good quality recording.
Yeah.
What would be your dream find if you could choose one to find? What would be all your dream episodes?
Well, I think I'd have to go for one of the other Harry Secombe episodes of The Racehorse, because the sound effect of the clip-clop-bonk of the horse, and just, it seems very madcap. I think Harry Secombe really would have played that with a great deal of giggling and fun, and that one just has a wonderful plot to it.
And is this, I don't know if this is right, is that the first one that would have had Snide, The Racehorse?
Yes, I believe so.
So it would again be a historic one to have, because it would be the very first appearance of Snide character that Kenneth Williams played.
Sorry, didn't we discuss in a former podcast that it wasn't actually the first one, or was it?
Everyone thinks of the rail strike, don't they?
Yeah, that was
it. Rail strike's the first one that still exists.
I think my favourite of the ones that are missing is the Matador.
I was just going to say that, yeah.
Or the Red Planet. Those two, I think, would be top of my list. And particularly with the Matador, because when the Missing Hancocks recreated it, they got a bit of a surprise because it came up to about 25 minutes. And Ray and Alan, I think, said that they thought that the only surviving script was for the edited version, which is why it only came up to the 25 minutes. So actually hearing the original of that might have more in it than the surviving script has, which again would be a lovely thing to hear.
Potentially, yeah.
Those are my two. Those are my two top of the list for missing. Outside of the, I mean, Harry Seacombe one would be great as well.
The other one I'd like to see is the other one that's, I mean, you mentioned two of them, Martin, that are being performed by the Apollo Theatre Group, were performed recently by them. But the other one, when they do the day trip to Brighton, remind me what that's called.
Winter Holiday.
Winter Holiday. I'd love to have that one recovered. I think that's fantastic. Great episode.
Yeah, it is actually. I mean, I having re-listened to it recently for the interview with the chaps, I was like, oh, of their performance previously 10 years ago, that one does stand up as good. And the thing with the Missing Hancocks as well is that I suspect that the Missing Hancocks had a faster-paced delivery than the original one. I'd think there'd have been a lot more pauses in the original one. I think there was maybe a slightly more nervous, frenetic energy in the Missing Hancocks, and therefore they seemed to mostly run to 28 minutes rather than 30 minutes. But, I don't know. It's all supposition.
Indeed. Cool. So, as the usual appeal goes out to any listeners, if you do have any reel-to-reel tapes, we'd love to hear from you and have a listen to see if there is anything that is either a missing episode or an episode where the only version of the episode that survives is an edited one. Because, as I said, Ted Kendall, when he provided the recordings for the collectibles, that was 8 or 9, can't remember how many, extended episodes. So I'm sure there are more out there.
There is a third category as well, which is where the quality is better. Because if you look, for example, at Sid James' dad.
That's one I wanted to,
The diet.
I mean, the Missing Hancocks, the BBC wouldn't allow the Missing Hancocks to redo those. They said there's no need, they already exist. But the quality is so poor that you really can't listen to them. So it's a shame, really, that they're not easily listened to and they haven't been recreated. But wouldn't it be nice if the original versions turned up in listenable quality? That'd be lovely.
Amount of times I've tried to listen to Sid James' dad because I really like it, and you can make out little bits, but it gets really difficult to listen to. Yeah. You actually get quite tired listening to it because you're focusing for so long.
Yeah.
Hello, son. Well, go on, say hello to him. Hello, Daddy. Let me look at you, son. Oh, dear. 25 years. What have you done in all that time, son?
About 23.
Oh, I can't get over it. He looks just like his mother.
Oh, dear, a poor old lady.
How have you been keeping, son?
All right, Daddy. You?
Very well, very well, yes.
How's Mummy?
Oh, sorry. Oh, yes, she says, are you still taking your condiment oil and milk?
Well, no.
Oh, you should. Oh, you're a very naughty boy. You always were a delicate child.
Daddy, I'm 40 now.
Maybe one day AI and technology will be able to get a pristine kind of sounding recording out of that, but that's probably a little way off. There's, of course, if we ever do a podcast on it, I'll have to send you James Hearn's performance of Sid James's dad, which I have a little recording of it scrawled away in the archive. And in fact, I think even he had to edit it slightly because it overran when he performed it live longer than intended. So it's quite a lengthy script. I think it's about a 31-minute episode, 31 and a half minutes. So if only they were all that long, you know. You never know. Maybe some of them were. We don't know now.
Yes, Paul, it's quite possible because I think there's quite a bit comes out from the script, either in rehearsal or in editing before broadcast.
Other bit of news, wasn't there? There was a little bit of news that our little podcast was mentioned on the episode of The Chase.
Yeah, we had a tweet from our good friend Julian Dutton. Well, he sent me a DM, actually. Julian must have been watching TV one afternoon and fell off his chair when one of the questions on The Chase, which is a quiz program on ITV1, said very nearly an armful, the podcast is about which comedian, and gave the contestant a choice of four.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just a reference to Hancock, it was a reference to this very podcast. So our famous spread to the colonies, as someone once said.
Which comedian is the subject of the podcast Very Nearly an Armful? A, Tony Hancock. B, Spike Milligan. C, Frankie Howard. You've put Tony Hancock. Correct answer is, yeah. Well placed, up close to home. Chase is put. Railway cuttings.
You seemed unsure. Was that a guess?
It was a bit of a guess. It was between Hancock and Howard.
It's a reference to one of his sketches in which he's decided to be a blood donor. And he's told that they're going to take a pint of his blood. And he goes, a pint? That's nearly an armful.
Yeah. No, I remember the sketch. I just couldn't quite remember which one was in it.
Did you see one of the later questions as well, Tim?
No.
It said, what colour was Tim Elm's headphones in Throwing It in Armful?
Yeah, that was it. Well, yeah.
Well, I sometimes wear these in the street when I'm listening to my iPod. And one of my friends said, I saw you in the street the other day with your pink earmuffs on.
Nice. I think one of the researchers on the production team obviously must be a listener and a fan to our podcast.
Yeah.
So hello.
Yeah, absolutely.
I definitely didn't have on my 2023 bingo card, you know, a former Doctor Who companion mentioning our podcast by name on national telly. So that's quite fun. So then, I guess now it's time for our main subject, Fred's Pie Stall. So, I think, barring Tim, because we know what he thinks, what do we think of this one, guys?
I'll shut up for 30 minutes.
So. Impossible.
I'm going to go first, because it's my favourite episode.
You go first, Tim.
Yeah, go on, Tim.
I mean, obviously it's my favourite. I've said all along it's my favourite, and I think it's a really good episode. I've been trying to figure out why it's my favourite, and sometimes it's difficult to work it out, but I think what I do like about it, as I often say about these programs, is the script. And this is a brilliant script by Ray and Allen. Clearly, if you're a fan of Hancock and you've listened to Hancock's half hour from the start of the first series right the way through, you'll know what they were trying to do and get sort of more real comedy from the from the characters rather than gag-driven and all that. And this, to me, when you go through it and you look at the script, it's hilarious without there being any jokes in it. It's just beautifully written. And the other thing for me is that one reason why I think I like this episode, it just conjures up this beautiful picture in the mind. And I think we've mentioned before, I think we've all mentioned that when you listen to Hancock on the radio, you conjure up this image, don't you? And you close your eyes, or you can sit down with your eyes closed, or lay in bed or whatever, and you're listening to this, and you have this image, whether it's the rail strike or anything else. And with Fred's pie stall, you know, the thought of them standing around the pie stall talking about the film they've just seen and the bird they fancied in the second picture and all this, and dipping their pies in the sauce, I just think it's wonderful, and it's sort of, some respect, conjures up images of my youth. I mean, I know I didn't see any pie stalls.
You're a little bit later than that. You're not quite that old, Tim.
Yes, I'm not quite that old. But, you know, certainly the kebab stand or the hot dog stand or whatever, you know. And it's the sort of thing, you know, when you'd been out on a Saturday night or Friday night, you know, everyone, and even now, you know, you see the takeaways, those sort of places, quite busy late at night.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It's that sort of image that it, and also the storyline, you know, this whole thing about gentrification is so valid today, and it's never been invalid. And I think it makes it, for that reason, it makes it timeless. I remember the first time I got it, I think, you know, for many years, the only episode I sort of knew was a blood donor on the radio ham from the RP. And it was only when they started coming out on cassette that I started. And I remember getting this one on cassette. I used to borrow them from the library near where I worked and play them in the car. And at one stage, I used to go up to Leeds quite often with work, and I used to take a couple of Hancocks on my trip up the A1. And I remember getting this one of Fred's Pie Stall, and I can remember sitting behind the wheel, chuckling away, coming down the A1. Sure. You know, it's absolutely fantastic.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a brilliant, I agree with you, it is a brilliant episode. And you talk about Hancock's half hour becoming more realistic towards the end of this series, which is absolutely right. Mm. And I think that's another reason why I like this one, because it's probably one of the best episodes to reflect all the changes in society in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. You've got the birth of the coffee bar, which I think first one of those opened in the central London in about 1952 or 53, with this newfangled gaggier espresso machine, which was completely new. And then you've got all the changes around the high street with the butchers and butcher, baker and candlestick maker, if you like, all disappearing in favour of a supermarket. And I just think it's got everything there that would, I mean, we find it funny, but I think it would have reflected back the society to the society of the day, all the changes that they were actually experiencing that would have given it even more humour to those listening in when it was first broadcast.
This is why Hancock's half hour is social history, isn't it? All these episodes, not just this one, you're hearing about life in the 1950s, whether it's this sort of thing, whether it's, you know, the poetry society and the arts movement or a rail strike, whatever it is, it's everyday life reflected in comedy.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is still relevant in that respect because, you know, they talk about, you know, all the butchers and things like that. And there are several butcher shops that were in Colchester that are all closed down and have done in the last 20 years. So it's still sort of relevant. Yeah. But then again, they talk about, you know, I don't like wrapping all this stuff up in plastic in refrigerators. And of course, we're now aware of microplastics and how actually wrapping stuff in plastic is probably not as ideal as slightly more natural materials, perhaps.
I don't hold with all this wrapping stuff up and keeping it in refrigerators. Takes all the goodness out of it. I like to see him hack it off and whop it on the scales, mate.
Yeah, well, it's more hygienic the other way.
Rubbish. My grandfather lived to be 97 and he never saw a plastic bag in his life. All this hygiene stuff may be very nice, but it takes all the charm out of things. I ask you, what have you got when you buy a spud today? 27 different fertilisers done up in a jacket.
And that's the other thing, isn't it? For the first 15 minutes, for the first half of the episode, they don't even leave the house.
No.
They're just having a chat about this, that and the other. It's not until halfway through that they actually go and meet Fred.
That's right.
Then we get
it's about 16 minutes in, isn't it?
About halfway, 15, 16 minutes.
Yeah. I found it really interesting that I think if you look at that time where the people they're complaining about are people who, you know, wear their brother's jumper working in these coffee shops, but now it's incredibly fashionable, and you would call those people hipsters. They're probably the old-fashioned butchers. They would like to shop in those places. It's funny how society goes round. But like I say, it's a real, Tim's right, it's a complete cultural commentary at the top of the time, isn't it? The whole episode is one big cultural reference.
Yes, it is.
I think this one, possibly more than any other episode, has got that greater cultural significance, I think.
Even like little things like With or without handles.
Handles.
With or without. Handles. Only, you see, some clients prefer them without handles, and then they can warm their hands around it.
Come now, Fred, you should know by now I always have handles. Lots of ladies pass by, and it's very hard to cock the little finger when it's wrapped round a mug of coffee.
Yes, you can't cock the finger at the ladies if you've got your hand wrapped around a mug of warm coffee, can you?
But you can, you can imagine.
That's the best line, isn't it?
whenever anyone quotes that line on Twitter, they always spell it with W-I-V or without W-I-V-A-T. But in fact, in the script, it's very clearly with or without.
Yeah, so well, it's... Well, I suppose that's Harry Taub, we believe, plays Fred.
Pronunciation,
He's an Irishman, so he's doing a very mannered Cockney as Fred. And I was listening to the different voices in this, because, of course, you've got Harry Taub. I think he also potentially plays the mayor, who's got a similar sort of cadence to his voice, but I could be wrong.
You're cordially invited to a gala night at Fred's pie stall under the statue in the market square. Parking space available on the left-hand side of the road on even dates. Open-air cafeteria, ornamental horse trough. Dine under the stars with the stars. Music by Elvis Dalrymple and his moonlight serenaders. Excitingly new Cockney menu, licensed to sell fags. If wet, room for 12 under the shutter.
And then we've got Wilfred Babbage, who I'm fairly sure plays Lord Cheam, because Wilfred Babbage was in the Christmas Club and is there. Sorry, sir, we've got no, you know, machinery for returning money.
Oh, right, yeah.
My dear Lord Cheam, the villagers of whom I am their humble spokesman would be grateful if you and her ladyship would consent to come down amongst us on the occasion of the simple village festivities in the market square. We cannot, of course, hope to compete with the glittering hunt balls that you gents throw,
And then you've got Hugh Morton, I think, plays the vicar and probably one or two other roles.
Your utmost reverence, sir, your presence is requested at a simple frugal pie nosh-up in the market square. We hope several esteemed members of your flock will also be in attendance.
Those three actors, although obviously you don't have Kenneth in this series, they're playing three different characters and they're each playing each other's butlers or something as well. So, but they're all quite different voices, you know, listening to this one. So it's quite difficult to tell, and it's obviously not on the cast list.
Well, I love the way that Hancock really sort of sucks up in these letters, like, sorry, we didn't provide you with your hog's head this year at a harvest supper. And it's just...
And your suckling pigs or something like that as well. Yeah.
But we think you may find some amusement in watching the simple villagers in their natural surroundings. We apologise for the delay due to the bad harvest in sending you the annual hogshead of cider, field of corn, and 20 sucking pigs.
I love the way in those letters he addresses the vicar, your utmost reverend sir, and then he refers to his wife as the Mrs. Reverend.
The Mrs. Reverend.
The meeting, though secular in conception, will be ecclesiastical in decorum. So we have no fears about bringing along the good soul, your charming lady spouse, the Mrs. Reverend.
The opening sequence is a great one. It goes on, as we said just now, for 16 minutes or so. And what is quite interesting, when it starts, Hancock is saying to Sid, you know, have you heard, you know, that the council have told Fred he's got to, you know, leave the market square. And Sid goes, no, has he? Yeah, blah, 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 blah. So at that point, Sid is unaware, but 30 seconds later, Sid is telling Hancock all the reasons why the council are doing it. It's one of these lovely little inconsistencies, isn't it? When you look at the script, it just doesn't make sense. But when you listen to it, it works.
It just seems true to flow. But it is a good little inconsistency, that, isn't it?
Well, you know, was it the rag and bone man's horse died last year? The vet said this animal died because it was clogged up with tea leaves. Because he kept washing them out in the horse trough. Which is quite a wonderful line.
He's been washing his cups out in the horse trough for years. Why have they only just noticed it? Anyway, what's wrong with it? It's running water.
Yeah, well, maybe it is. But you cannot deny that the rag and bone man's horse died last year.
Well, what's that got to do with it?
Well, the vet said in his post-mortem, this animal died because it was clogged up with tea leaves.
And of course, if we're talking about the opening sequence, for those listening to this episode on BBC Sounds, you probably haven't heard the full-length version. We mentioned Ted Kendall earlier. He found an original recording, which is on the Hancock Sapphire Collectibles Volume 4, which has got a significantly extended, well, guess what, sequence.
I quite like the extended version.
Yeah, it's fun because the original, the edited version that most people know runs to 29 minutes, 14 seconds, and this version runs to 30 minutes, 30 seconds. So it's a minute and a half or a minute and a quarter longer. But Bill's section, he enters at 3 minutes, 45, and he only eventually tells Tony at 5 minutes, 45. So it runs for a whole 2 minutes of guess what?
Now, come on, tell me. You know I can't stand playing around when there's something I don't know about going around.
Well, you promise you won't tell anybody?
Yes, yes.
Word of honour?
Yes, yes, scout's honour. Hick, hike, hock, cross me heart, nope to die.
That's obviously the bit that's halved in the edited version, but I loved hearing that for the first time only a few years ago on the CD release. And he just goes on and drives Hancock mad. As Tim said, shut up, just tell me. Can't stand people knowing things that I don't know and not telling me. I think that winds you up, doesn't it, Tim?
I think I can just about stomach the edited version. I think the extended version, which presumably is the original, goes on for 2 minutes. And as much as I love this episode, as much as I love Gorton Simpson, I think that's just a little bit too much.
Maybe.
And, you know, sometimes when the writers employ this device, and, you know, it's like the knock on the door sequence in the Christmas one. We've talked about that before and how long. And to me, that is just sheer brilliance. It goes on. You don't get fed up with it. You can listen to it. And to some extent, Sunday afternoon at home, you know, you get periods of sighing and whatever. But this, I just think this is a tad too long. It's a great idea, but I have to say it does infuriate. To be honest, the shorter version infuriates me a bit, but the longer one, you know, when they said, oh, we've got a longer version of this, or fantastic, longer version of Fred Pistol, and then you get a longer version of this sequence. Oh, my God.
No extra Fred in it, as far as I can ascertain, yeah.
I must admit, when I was listening to this episode to prepare for the podcast, and I'd heard it, the extended version, several times, and I, you know, I did enjoy, same as you, I enjoyed the extended version, John.
Come on, tell me.
Well, have a guess. tell me. Well, no, I don't think you ought to know.
Oh, my blood pressure. Do hate people who say, guess what I know, and they won't tell you.
But having listened to it several times over and over before doing this podcast, it was beginning to wind me up a little as well.
Yeah. Understandable.
I think it's still quite new to me. So I think I'm still enjoying that. I did enjoy that. Mrs. Gibbs has got a new boyfriend? Is that one of the things Bill says? Is it Mrs. Gibbs?
It's Mrs. something, isn't it? I can't quite remember.
I wrote down Mrs. Gibbs, but I'm doubting myself.
Well, I'll put the clip in.
It's probably
Biggs.
It's probably Mrs. Biggs.
B-I-double-G-S. Yeah.
Well, she has got a new boyfriend, but that's not it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you won't guess. All right, then. I'll have a guess.
Mrs. Biggs has got a new boyfriend.
No. Well, she has, but that's not it.
Yes, it's Mrs. Biggs.
Mrs. Biggs,
yeah.
I was wondering, when I was listening to it, if there's any other reference to any other characters that you don't ever hear from.
Young Elvis Dalrymple, you know. That's a wonderful name, isn't it?
It is, isn't it, yeah.
But you do hear him.
Too Bob to forget Skiffle for the night.
I just thought it was a bit of trivia. I don't know if anyone thought of any characters that ever mentioned.
Higgins.
Oh, Higgins, yeah.
Oh, well, Higgins was a famous one that was even in Star Bill.
And wasn't some of Sid's dodgy mates never heard? I know
I think
Kenneth did some of them, didn't he? Did he do them all?
He did do...
Edwardian Fred and Educated Albert and...
Edwardian
like
Fred
that.
Appeared in it. Kenneth Williams appeared as Edwardian Fred, but I just wonder if there's any more. Because I was thinking about it. I thought it was quite interesting to see who was on there. It's almost like a Only Fools and Horses one where... There's a character called Monkey Harris who you never ever meet, but you always hear about. I was just wondering if there's any more of those.
We had Denzel in goal. We had Monkey Harris left back. We had camaraderie.
Was that the Italian boy?
Yes, Trigg, that was the Italian boy.
Monkey Harris does appear in one, I think, doesn't he?
I don't think he does.
Who's the one in the Indian restaurant when...
It's not Monkey
when
Harris.
When Gerald goes... Right, okay.
Yeah, but like Captain Mannering's wife, you know.
Yeah,
always,
Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Elizabeth? Yeah. You know, all you ever see of her is her backside in a bunk bed, I think, isn't it?
That's as close as you get.
Hello, Elizabeth? Elizabeth?
They did the same question as this, you know, about characters that you... hear about but are never seen on the radio the other day on the morning show on Boom Radio. They did a similar sort of thing.
I did that. But I was interested in the food side of things, obviously being from a culinary background. The actual pie stand is absolutely superb. If I saw one now, I'd love to go for one. I think the snobbery around it, but I don't know if I'd lift up the crust and chop in a Savoy. Chuck in a Savoy.
Well, if it's a decent pie, there should be enough room for a Savoy, should there?
Yeah, if it's a decent pie.
You wouldn't think so. I don't think
they're high-quality gourmet food on Fred's Pie Stall somehow.
When I was a kid, we used to go to the fish and chip shop, and as a kid, I didn't like fish very much, and I always had something else. And, you know, I'd often have a pie, or I'd have a Savoy, or I'd have a sausage roll in batter. But I'd never have two of them. You never have a pie and a Savoy. I mean, it just seems outrageous.
Mustard on the pies.
Please. Oh, and lift the crust up and whop in a Savoy, will you?
Coming up.
Same for me, only put the mustard on the Savoy and cut off the curly bit at the end of the skin.
I think if you're just having a pie, though, like no mashed potato, no carbs.
No mash or chips. They don't mention carbs, do they? Yeah.
No, they don't.
You'd almost lean up against it as well, wouldn't you, I guess?
But it's interesting, though, because they go to Fred and they have all that food, and then when they've decided what their action's going to be, they have a bacon sandwich afterwards.
Yeah.
But I love dessert. The fact that's the dessert.
I tell you what, us three will be waiters for the night.
I can't pay you.
That's all right. Just give us a free hot dog every night for a year.
Done.
Right. I'll get the invitation sent out tomorrow. I think this calls for a celebration. Fred, 3 bacon sandwiches, please. Gentlemen, raise your mugs. I give you Fred's pie stall. Long may the wedges stay under its cartwheels.
But they talk about, what do they talk about? Pie and eel shops that have disappeared.
Peas pudding.
Well, that's... and peas pudding shops.
Yeah.
One of my relatives had a peas pudding shop.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, about well over 100 years ago now in Bristol.
Oh. Yeah, you can buy tins of peas pudding in some supermarkets, I think.
It's quite easy to make.
Yeah. So what is it? Yeah, peas that are mushed up or something? Or...
It's like marrow fat peas, but they're cooked in like ham stock, like ham liquor. So when you boil your dirty great hams, you save the water and you put your marrow fat peas in, you've got like hammy peas. It's really nice.
Did you put onion in as well, James?
Oh yeah, I think I boiled onion in there as well. It was like a proper cheap food, but it's lovely, peas pudding.
When I was a kid, we used to go along the seafront at Hastings, where I live, and there used to be, you know, in the same way that you go today and you get hot dogs and candy floss. And I remember a place, and my mum and dad would often drive us down to the seafront specifically to get this. I think it was the only one there. But it was really nice. But you can buy Mr. Brown's. It's a West Country delicacy, isn't it? You can buy them if you go to any sort of decent West Country town and they've got what I call a proper butcher's where they do their own stuff.
You won't find the real ones, though, like the because what they tend to do now is pre-cook them. Like the pre-cooked ones are quite nasty. But because if you put an offal and heart and liver and
lung, my lover.
You'd only get
love your liver.
About a day and a half before they start to turn green, unfortunately.
So what you meant to do then? Buy them raw?
I would say if I was going to a butcher, you'd want to buy them raw and then cook them yourself. But when they've all been sort of steamed in mass production, which is what they tend to do now, they're not as good. But, the snobbery in me, I think.
And what about Mr. Brains' then?
Mr. Brown, I was going to say, you see those in the supermarkets, don't you? I've never... gone as far as buying them because they're probably
awful. I have to
say,
I do love a Mr. Brown's.
When you pre-cook them in their vat pack, they last about 10 days. I've made quite a few now, but chop up your liver and you put all your stuff in there, it just turns green after about a day and a half. They just get really, really wet. You've got to cook them quite quickly. Anyway, I digress.
And for the next edition of this cookery show, please tune in next week.
I'll show you how to fillet haddock.
What is it? As Sid says, he has, three daubs of peas pudding, a saveloy, and 2 pig strotters, which doesn't sound that appealing. Never more than 10p.
3 a pudding, 2 fags, a sav, and a couple of pigs. Never more than 10p. And on a coronation day, 2 extra faggots and a spoon with a crest on it. So there's nothing like that these days. Old Fred's pie stall is the last remaining link with those halcyon days, and they want to get rid of him.
Where are we going to go after the pictures on a Saturday night?
You may well ask.
Yeah, that sounds like quite a meaty collection of dish.
I remember pig's trotters, too. We used to have those.
Yeah, love pig's trotters.
They used to be boiled, yeah.
And I was going to ask about the salt on the clock.
Is that... a block of salt. Yeah.
Block of salt.
You just scrape it off with a knife, I suppose, like a solid lump, isn't it?
But does he say scrape it off the clock?
No, off the block.
Oh, off the block. I was thinking clock.
Yeah, off the block. What they did, they'd have a block of salt on the counter, and you just picked it up, scraped a bit off, and put it back down again.
See, in my mind's eye, very hygienic. In my mind's eye, there's a clock encased in salt or something.
Yeah, that would be a weird image. Oh. Yeah, it's not unlike salt licks that you have for pets, isn't it? They've got a lump of salt thing that they just sort of lick occasionally.
It's a bitter blow to we gourmets.
Yeah, I'm pretty choked about it myself.
We feel that... You got any salt there, Fred?
Here's a knife. Scrape some off the block.
Thank you.
Martin mentioned just now that they also referred to, what is it, Pioneer
shops.
But that is a line that's cut out there, Martin. It's not even in the extended version. Did you get that from the script? Because I saw it in the script when I was listening to the extended version at the time.
Oh, that's a bit that's been cut, I think.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Whether it was cut before broadcast or not, I don't know. But
that's right.
It struck me there might be an even longer version available somewhere.
Well, there's always possible. And whilst we're talking about the script, my favourite bit There wasn't that much in the script that was cut, and I suppose that's because we've now got an original length version, was a bit where Bill says there must be some way of keeping the pie stall, to which Sid says, I wonder if the National Trust would be interested. And Tony says, well, they don't go in for pie stalls, do they? They're more interested in buildings and tops of mountains and things. To which Bill says, what for? And Tony says, I don't know, something to do with stopping you building bungalows on the top of Ben Nevis, I think. Yeah. I just thought that was wonderful. What a shame that bit wasn't in.
Yeah.
A great couple of lines. But whilst we're on the subject of the food, of course, at the very end of the episode, and I'm not going to say a word about it being possibly circular, because they decide they're going to go to these coffee houses after all. And he says he's going to go and have this plate of ravioli because they're like just a plate of little meat pies, aren't they? I thought that was a lovely image.
Yes, one way of putting it, yeah.
Those Frankfurters, they're just like Savoy's. I mean, a bit skinnier, but none the worse for that.
Yeah, and that ravioli stuff's just like a plate of little meat pies, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. Yes, there's a lot to be said for coffee houses.
Omelette Valenciana. Spanish omelette, in other words.
Spanish omelette, yes, at the El Granada.
Yep, and of course there's that thing about frothy coffee. You know, the coffee's not too bad once you've blown the froth off.
My favourite line is when he goes, when he's talking to Sid, he goes, of course, I did make a fool of myself. I said, bring me a new cup of sugar. Someone's put a coffee in this one.
Yeah, that was right.
The brown very sugar, relatable.
Yeah. Yeah, and would you like a cappuccino? I don't want the chino, but I'll have a cup of tea.
Yeah.
How plebeian? What does that mean? You're a scruff bag.
It's from the Latin plebes. It means you're a scruff bag. Yeah, that's a great line.
What's plebeian?
Plebeian. It's from the Latin plebes, defined by Pliny as derivative from plebiscum.
Yeah, but what does it mean?
It means you're a scruff bag.
I mean, they've got some, there's another thing, isn't there? They're talking about foreigners and cities, yeah?
Yeah. There's too many foreigners in the world. You can't go anywhere abroad without meeting them.
Quite. And they're all coming over here for their holidays. That's what bothers me.
You can't go anywhere abroad without meeting them. It's just, they are such dunces, the three of them, really, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes.
Self-depreciating humour, though, isn't it? It's really taking a mickey out of the Little Englander, I guess, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's that thing of, as well, they say, you know, it's like, well, I went to the cafe, you know, I said...
How can you have a sandwich without a lump of bread stuck on top? That's what they tried to palm me off with. An open sandwich, they called it. Bits of meat and carrots and stuff squeezed out a tube. Well, I kicked up a fuss.
I don't blame you.
I told her straight. I said, look, dear, I don't know where you come from. Well, I knew she wasn't English. She spoke it too well.
You know, it's an open sandwich. So whack another slice on top. Cost me another 9p, you know.
That's one of the best lines in the whole programme.
Yeah, that's right. The open sandwich.
And again, it's not necessarily a gag, although it's got a funny ending. It's just, you can imagine someone just standing there. It's just telling a story like that. It's just so, it's so beautifully written.
Yes.
Amusing comment on life. Yeah.
I don't know where you're from, love, but where we're from, we haven't had bread Russians here for years.
Yes.
So good.
I mean, that is just so Hancock, isn't it? Yeah. You can imagine him standing in a cafe saying that to the girl behind the counter.
That could be a scene, like an earlier scene, if he is in there, you know, you could quite easily get a scene out of it. You could just picture it all, can't you?
You could picture this expanded into a film script, couldn't you?
Yeah, definitely.
You know, there's so much more backstory that could be added. But thinking about everybody overseas being a foreigner, I just love the fact that Fred is from Italy.
He's not
British at all. What is he? Giuseppe Antonio.
Giuseppe Antonio. Well, it wouldn't look right over a pie stall, would
pie
it?
Pie stall, would it? So he called himself Fred.
I did think, was it hoop earrings for a bit?
Presumably his dad was called Fred as well, if it's his dad's pie stall that he took over. So who knows?
Of course, yes, because he took over from his
dad.
Maybe
he's half Italian.
Yeah. Maybe it's just a name that they adopted. I'm just speculating now, but if they come over...
Business name from Italy.
Well, let's call it Fred because that's an English name. Can't call it Giuseppe's Pie Store. Fred, let's call it Fred's Pie Store. And then he's known as Fred.
And as you were saying, James, the thing of, yes, a hoop earrings and a bandana didn't seem the look of a Surrey man is a great line as well, isn't yeah. it?
Is he a foreigner, then? Only by birth. Still, come to think of it, I'm not surprised. I always thought a red bandana and gold earrings wasn't the hallmark of a Surrey man.
Yeah, well, I thought he was a bit eccentric, that's all.
Still, he's practically British. He came over when he was three to take over the pie stall when his dad died. Oh, well, that's it, then. That's good enough for me. As far as I'm concerned, anyone who flogs meat pies is British. I don't care where he was born.
It's that sort of, as you say, the Little Englander kind of... He strikes me as being a terrible bore that you wouldn't really want to get into conversation with in the pub somehow. <Yeah.
laughs> He's quite surprised that Fred is Italian, and you think he's going to take umbrage, but then he just swings 180 degrees, doesn't he, and say, well, doesn't matter what nationality is, you know.
Well, yes.
Yeah, if he serves pie from a pie stall, he's British. Yeah, absolutely. Another bit that I mean, the timing as you go through this from all the cast, including the ones that aren't regulars, is brilliant. But the one that I really noticed where the timing was absolutely perfect was when Tony says, "I know what we'll do. We'll set up a Friends of the Pie Stall." To which Sid jumps straight in and says, "I'll be treasurer." And Tony immediately responds, "You won't."
They said the store was out of keeping with the rest of the square and now we're the town of the district.
Well, Fred, we are going to help you.
Really?
We're going to organise on your behalf. We'll start a movement, the Friends of the Pie Stall.
I'll be treasurer.
You won't.
That's exactly like the line in East Cheam Centenary, isn't it? And elements of the plot sort of remind me a little bit of the economy drive where he goes to the cafe and all of that kind of thing. It's a similar sort of setup, isn't it? Obviously, you know, but with pie stalls. He has a wonderful insult for Bill as well. "You great witless dandy."
Dandy,
I love that. I want to use that. I have to start using that in everyday use, you know.
It's a superb script, isn't it, from start to finish? And, you know, it's lines like that, again, not necessarily a gag, but just beautifully written and just so funny.
What does it mean? It means liberty, equality, and fraternity. What else could it mean, you great witless dandy?
All right, it doesn't say that on the Statue of Liberty.
Well, it says it somewhere.
I love how he paints a picture of how they'll do up the pie stall as well. Put some goldfish in the horse trough.
String of lights, and I can't remember what he's when he hooks them round.
Bit of bunting.
And he describes it, is it Grace's birthday in Monte Carlo? Or something like that. He describes it, doesn't he?
He does.
Describe it?
Something like that.
Yeah. But I just love how he's describing the pie stall. It sort of sounds quite grand.
Well, we'll get the place done up a bit. Give it a coat of paint and the coloured lights strung up from the top of Queen Victoria's crown, hooked round your stovepipe, then across the horse trough. The reflections look lovely on the water. Oh, very Venetian, that'll be. Then tie him round the gargoyle so the two jets of water coming out of his ears will be lit up. A sort of Fountains of Rome effect. A few tables and chairs out in the roadway. Put some goldfish in the horse trough. It'll look like Monte Carlo on Grace's birthday.
I like it when he says at a pie stall about the smell of the place. And he says, "It drives me crackers. Isn't it marvellous? Sensual. Better than all your posh scent. If only I could find a bird who smells like this, I'd marry her like a shot." And what a fantastic sobriety.
Yeah, but what an awful smell the bird must have if it was that kind of perfume. So stale beer and faggins or something, you know.
If only I could find a lady who uses scent like this, I'd marry her like a shot.
Here you are. Three pies, two myself, one in, one out. Three coffees, one went, two went out.
Thanks very much. Very nice indeed, mate.
And of course, the wonderful visual image that I get from this one that's always stuck with me. I mean, I only first heard this in the early noughties when I borrowed it from the Society's audio library from young Mick Dawson back in the day. So I first heard this a mere 20 years ago. But Bill's solution is to get all the pie stalls in Surrey in a big circle to hold off the police like in Whack and Train, which is a great image, isn't it?
I know what we can do. The strategist is about to speak. We must hold them off, keep them at bay.
Brilliant. How do we keep the whole of the East Cheam Constabulary at bay?
Easy. We go around and collect every available pie stall in Surrey.
Yes.
Then we bring them all into the market square.
Yes.
Well? Then when the police come, we put the pie stalls in a big circle and hold them off. Like they do in Wagon Train.
James is going to ask about Wagon Train now, so we'll wait
tell,
for that question.
Tell me about Wagon Train. I can picture it, obviously, but yeah.
There were two big cowboy programs on in the 50s. I mean, I haven't looked this up. This is as I remember, so it might be a bit wrong. But there were two big cowboys. One was called Rawhide and one was called Wagon Train. Rawhide was the one where Clint Eastwood started as a cowboy or whatever. But Wagon Train, from my memory, was about these like convoys of wagons driven by horses that had settlers in, or cowboys as we called them, who were going across America to find the promised land, and obviously came across the local inhabitants whose land was being invaded in this way. And so it was often depicted that they'd be these wagon trains would be attacked by hordes of marauding Indians. And these Indians would attack with their bows and arrows. And what the wagon train used to do to defend themselves was put the wagons in a circle. Then all the people from the wagon train would be in the middle, and they'd be firing guns over the wheels at the marauding Indians. So it gave them protection, 360-degree protection. And so, you know, the Indians couldn't come around the back and shoot them or whatever, you know. If my memory serves me correct, this used to happen every week. You know, there was always someone attacking them, and bows and arrows flying.
Formulaic.
Yeah, it was a regular. But yeah. I love that the weapons this time are those in the circle are hurling pies. And the policemen are hurling lighted truncheons.
Yes.
Over the top of the pie stalls.
Over the top of the pie stalls.
Yeah. I hope one hits you.
Hiding behind the wheels, throwing meat pies at them. Yeah. I see. And they're all galloping round on their horses, chucking lighted truncheons at it. Yeah? Over the top of the pie stalls. Yeah. I hope one hits you.
Does he call him a beribboned buffoon? Is that...
No, well, that's
I think
in...
he calls him a witless dandy.
Witless dandy.
Witless dandy. Yeah.
I had in my head beribboned buffoon. I don't know why.
He does call him a poltroon elsewhere in the episode.
That's really a good one.
Beribboned buffoon, that's
it?
From the
lift.
The lift. Lift. That's
yeah,
from the lift.
Cool. Yeah, Mr. John Lemez.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, they've agreed to do all of this, for which they'll get a free hot dog every night for a year. And of course, at the end of the episode, they don't go and claim their free hot dog every night for the rest of
they
the year. Presumably
they can't
the
get
menu's
near.
Changed. Well, they can't get near it, yeah.
Well, the menu's changed because it's now champagne and saveloys for 3 guineas a head.
Yes.
And they can't afford to eat there.
Well, let's just go back a step about this free hot dog every night for a year.
I'm glad you said that, Tim, because I've done some calculations.
Because I've done some calculations too.
Maths is going.
It all depends how much you pay for a hot dog out on the street these days. And I think, like everything else, it varies enormously. But I think, on average, you couldn't complain if someone said £3.
Yeah.
Is that what you was working on, James?
£3 or £4, something like that.
If you open the hot dog stand, it won't last very long, mate.
When I was down at Bognor the other week for the Punch and Judy Festival, they were selling hot dogs there in a little stand on the seafront for £3, I think, or £4. But it was that sort of price.
I went off I use our purchasing database where we order hot dogs from, and a cost price of a hot dog that we sell in our pubs. It's about £1.25. That's the cost price.
Yeah.
And that's just the dog, no bun.
that's the hot dog and the bun.
All right.
You know, in a pub or a restaurant, you typically times it by, multiply it by 4.2.
Yeah.
To get your sale price. So
it's more like a fiver.
Well, the actual, yeah, it's about that. So it's for three of them to have a hot dog every night, it's £1,365 for a hot dog.
Blimey.
But that's cost price. And then if you're going to sell it, obviously, if they were selling that at a fiver, it's £5,733.
Golly.
I'd prefer to pay them for the night, I think.
Price of a hot dog these days. Yeah.
Me thinks Ryan Allen didn't think that through.
No.
I tried to reverse... reverse inflation on that to try and find out what it would be, but it
It's not easy to work it out exactly.
Well,
yeah.
it's about 30 times from Hancock days on average. Mm.
Okay.
Well, I looked at a similar thing because obviously, as Martin said, you know, champagne and Savoy is 3 guineas a head.
Have you tried to get near his stall lately? You can't see the counter for bowler hats and Bentleys.
I know, doesn't it make you sick? And of course, the prices have shot up. Champagne and Savoy's 3 guineas a head.
I looked that up. That's obviously £1, 1 shilling is a guinea. I think the BBC used to only work in guineas, didn't they?
They absolutely did. Yes, they did only work in guineas.
And according to some Bank of England website with inflation, that would be about £60 today, a champagne and a Savoy. Which is quite expensive, really, isn't it? Well, champagne's quite expensive, I suppose. Must be the posh stuff that Fred's
got. It's got to be a very posh champagne. And whilst we're thinking about prices, of course, Fred's gone off and built himself a brand new house with a roof shaped like a pie crust at £10,000.
He's done well since we saved his pie stall, hasn't he?
Done well. Have you seen that new house he's had built? £10,000 if it was a penny. And ostentatious. Fancy having a roof shaped like a pie crust.
What does that work out at today, then?
Well, that would be about 300,000 at a factor of 30. So it wouldn't be...
It would be more than that, surely.
Well, I think that shows how our house prices today are substantially more in real terms than they used to be. Yeah, that does show that.
That's true.
Yeah. We were talking earlier about the aristocracy in this, and of course we've got the wonderful Lord Cheam, who wants to go off to get his free fodder. But there's a good reason why he wants free fodder on the script that isn't in the episode.
Yeah.
Because when he gets his invite and the butler says, oh, do you want me to tear up the invite? Lord Cheam says, certainly not if there's some free grub going. We haven't had a square meal in weeks. Bad business last year. 23 half crowns don't go very far these days. I think I'll have to open a nudist colony here next year.
Well, sort of.
So he's on his uppers.
And he doesn't call it fodder in the script, does he? He calls it grub.
He calls it grub and not fodder. That's right. It says, Caroline, come down here. We're invited out to food, not pre-fodder. So that's changed.
Should I tear it up, sir?
Certainly not if there's some free fodder going. Caroline, come down here. We've been invited out for fodder.
I do love how the butler reacted. Should I tear it up, sir? It's totally beneath you.
Yeah. And I think that's why I'm fairly sure why that's Wilfred Babbage playing Lord Cheam, because he's got that sort of reedy sort of voice, you know, fodder. Yeah. Oh, he's got something in the thread like that. It's a great little performance as well. I think as well the line of, there'll be room for you to park your bubble car in the high street. bubble cars. My dad always wanted a bubble car.
License to sell fags.
Yeah.
Yes. There's a couple of different bubble cars, weren't there? Were they both German or was one
German.
Italian?
Was it Messerschmitt?
There was a Messerschmitt.
They had no reverse gear, did they? So if you parked in front of a wall, you were stuffed.
Well, they were motorbikes, weren't they?
Yeah.
They were, really. Yeah. You had a Messerschmitt. I think you had something called an Isetta.
That's the word, yeah.
An Isetta. I don't know if that was German as well.
There'll be plenty of room for you to park your bubble car in the high street. I am your humble, obedient village servant, Anthony Hancock, serf.
Yes, right.
I mean, I think if you think of, like, some of the guest cast, Harry Tell, obviously, I think someone mentioned on Twitter, didn't they, Tim, that they'd met Harry Tell years later and asked him what it was like appearing in it, and he couldn't remember a thing about it, could he?
That's right, yes. Yeah.
But, he was quite a character actor. He also appeared in Hancock's 1963 series as an Irish navvy in a cafe who chats up and goes off with Tony's Australian date in The Escort, that episode of the 63 series. He was the first victim of the master in Doctor Who, where he gets suffocated by a plastic chair.
Mr. Farrell tells me you've changed the mix. What right have you got to interfere? Do you know you've ruined a whole day's production?
You call this ruined?
Well, it's the wrong colour and the wrong texture. Of course it's ruined.
You don't appreciate its full potential, do you?
No, I don't want to. It doesn't meet our specifications.
This plastic has got unique properties, Mr. McDermott. Allow me to demonstrate.
In Terror of the Autons, I think he'd been in Doctor Who some years before playing an American in another, like, Patrick Troughton serial. He crops up in lots of 60s, 70s TV stuff. And probably one or two films, but he's a class act.
And it makes such a difference to the episode for this final series, having the apart from the first couple, which of course have got Kenneth, but having the actors, the straight actors in the cast, sort of gives it that extra sense of realism, I think.
Yeah, less of a kind of a sketch show sort of vibe, as it were, I suppose. Was this the only one Harry Taub ever did as Hancock's half-heir? I think it was.
That I don't know.
I believe so, unless Tim knows better.
No, that's, I'd have to look at...
Yeah, I have a feeling it's his only one.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that before. You might be right.
But you never know. I mean, they did record this series in pairs, so if they recorded two in one night, maybe he appears in another one.
Yes, of course. Yes, of course.
It is the only one with Harry Taub, but just had a look.
What about the show it was recorded with Martin? Is he not in that one?
So, interestingly, and you're right, these are generally recorded in pairs, but Fred's Pistol was recorded on the 17th of June, 59. The second one of the pair, The Elopement, which was the one that was broadcast the week before, was recorded on the 18th of June, the following day.
Oh, right.
Not in a pair this time. Most of them were in pairs, but this one wasn't. And The Elopement has got Lillian Grasson, Wilfred Babbage, again, Fraser Kerr and Lee Crutchley. So this is the only one with Harry.
I've just looked in the When the Wind Changed, which has a list of characters at the back, actors and how many appearances they made. And for Harry Taub, that just says one Hancock's half hour. So probably the only one then.
Yeah, that was it. That was it.
Yep. Yeah.
And of course, Tony in this one, he sort of goes full swing one way or the other way, and then the other way, doesn't he? You know, he doesn't like anything that's changed since he was a kid, which I think we can all relate to. What is it they say? Yeah. Anything invented before you were born is natural in the right order of things. Things invented when you're younger and new and exciting, and you can probably get a career in them. Anything invented after you're about 50 is just wrong and shouldn't, isn't right, and, you know, isn't like it was in the old days.
That's why this podcast is wrong.
That kind of thing. But, you know, he's so anti the kind of the coffee places and all of that, and for Fred's Pie Stall, and swings completely back the other way because just convenience is what you're used to, you know.
Yes, there's a lot to be said for coffee houses. Those girls aren't at all bad when you get close to them. I quite like green fingernails. Rather sensuous, I feel.
Yeah, it's what you get used to, isn't it?
Quite. It's all a matter of taste.
Yeah, well, personally, I couldn't care less if I never see another Savoy as long as I live.
Neither do I. I've never cared to think what Fred put in them, have you?
Well, now these things are clean, down at the coffee house.
Yes, there's a lot to be said for hygiene. Emptying his grouts into a horse trough, it wasn't very nice, was it?
Disgusting.
And, you know, green fingers, I quite like green fingers. They're rather sensual, aren't they? So he's a complete and utter hypocrite, as is always the case, of course.
Yes, he does go full circle on that, because I know when he starts off... Another fact, he talks about Bert the Butcher's and the picture of the cow on the wall, all coloured, so you know which bit you were going to get.
Yeah.
And then he says, I like to see him hack it off and whack it on the scales rather than all wrapped up in plastic. That's a lovely image, isn't it?
Yeah.
Butcher's shops with all the meat hanging up outside these days. They want it under glass, in refrigerators.
What? Old Bert the Butcher's? Best English and Scotch? It's his pride and joy to stand outside his shop in his striped apron and his straw hat, with his sausages dangling over the hooks for everybody to see. And his coloured map of a cow, all cut up so you know what bit to ask for.
And then later they're saying about how unhygienic it is, not very nice washing his cups out in the horse's trough after all.
Should have been closed out years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
And the image of his mum and dad standing outside the pie stall.
Yes.
Dad was okay because he had a cup of tea and a plate of Savoy's, but it was his mum wrapping her teeth around a fried egg sandwich.
Yeah. But that is, again, it's great, isn't it?
Incredible use of language, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And it's not, again, it's not a gag, but you just burst out laughing. It's just
how it's said,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's beautiful.
Brilliant. Yeah.
In fact, and this is not very well known, actually, I'll take you into my confidence here. If you get a magnifying glass out and study the group standing round the pie stall, do you know who you'll see?
Who?
My father. He's the one in the bowler hat and the knotted scarf. Holding a cup of tea and a plate of Savoy's, if I remember rightly. And next to him is his good lady wife, my mother, wrapping her teeth round a fried egg sandwich.
This really was a joy to listen to, wasn't it, from start to finish for me. Yeah. I haven't listened to it for a while, but... Oh. This last week or so, I've been listening to it. It's been absolutely brilliant.
And you know something? You can't get a roll of butter anymore. It's croissant au beurre.
But isn't croissant fish?
Croissant.
Croissant.
Oh, croissant. I always heard it as poisson for some reason rather than croissant. I did wonder, yeah.
The poisson's just below the salt clock.
Butter fish. Yeah.
Just below the salt clock.
Not quite the same.
Yeah,
that's yeah. It. Yeah, that'll get them confused in Costa Coffee when you go for breakfast.
Yeah. And then, of course, when he's describing all the clientele of these coffee shops, I love the way he says, as you say, you mentioned the green fingernails, but they're all looking at their omnibus edition of Ibsen.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is Ibsen?
Yes. He's a poet, wasn't he?
No, he's a Norwegian playwright. I mean, he's sort of end of the 1800s, early 1900s. And I think when I looked him up, it said that he's probably the most performed playwright after Shakespeare. So apparently a very, very popular playwright. I think he was all sort of realist, modernist type plays. So quite new for the day.
Black stocking fools. Sitting there with their green fingernails and their omnibus edition of Ibsen. Got no time for them. Show me the piece of apple strudel that compares to one of Fred's stale cheesecakes.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I think it chimes with Hancock's pseudo-intellectualism, doesn't it, really?
Yeah.
It does. Yes, it does.
In the same way that he liked the philosophy and things like that. You can imagine Hancock like in Ibsen in real life, you know. And
the writers reflected that in the things that he then took the mickey out of as a character. Yeah. You know, they're all the things that he was passionate about to some extent, like Bertie Russell.
Absolutely. And then he thought Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité was on the Statue of Liberty. So it sort of he let the side down there, didn't he?
Well, it's written somewhere.
It's on the guillotine.
On the blade of the guillotine.
There's a cut line there on the Statue of Liberty thing where he says, as the inscription says on the Statue of Liberty, Sid butts in and says, Queen Mary to the left, Queen Elizabeth to the right.
Ah, yes.
So,
yes, that was cut, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But then in that little speech just before he mentions that, there's this wonderful little, another fantastic little Hancock speech where he says, to speak his mind is every man's right. In peace, battle, war, hostilities, uprising, floods, tempests, acts of God, and motor car accidents.
Motor car accidents, yes.
A lovely ending to that.
Well, yeah, I'd say it's a wonderfully written line.
Anyway, the point is, does Fred want to go?
Oh, no, he doesn't. He's very cut up about it. He's been there all his life.
Well, that's it then. His freedom is being encroached upon. He should have the right to trade where he likes. To speak his mind is every free man's right. In peace, battle, war, hostilities, uprisings, floods, tempests, force majeure, and motor car accidents. Magna Carta, Runnymede, 1793. Henry VIII versus the Barons, Barons talking.
So then, I guess then it's time for the scores. So what do you think you're going to give that one, Tim, as if I didn't know?
I think he's going to give it a two, I think.
It could be a two. It could be a one and a half. Yeah.
Could be.
I cannot give this anything less than 10, needless to say. I think it's a brilliant episode. It's funny, it's not necessarily the best one. It's funny, isn't it, when you're picking your favourite as opposed to the best. They don't always have to be the same. I don't know what you guys think, but it's a bit like, you know, when people say, what is your favourite Beatles track or something like that? You know, your favourite one is not necessarily their best. And that's the same with this, because I think Sunday Afternoon at Home, to me, will always be very special because it's exceptionally clever and completely groundbreaking. This is not groundbreaking in that respect, but like many other episodes we talk about, particularly ones like The Blood Donor and certain others, I just think the script here is so fantastic. It's realistic.
Yeah.
It's real comedy. But it's not, you know, it's not just the writing, it's the performance as well. And it's the way that Hancock delivers these lines. It's writers and performer working in harmony. And the storyline is fantastic. It captures the imagination. It's real to life. It's timeless. You know, the things that went on now, you can relate to things that are going on today. And the Hancock character is, to me, is at his absolute best here. Absolutely wonderful. So I can't really fault it. I think the supporting cast, as always, are terrific. And it's great to hear the other actors who were brought in to play the other parts here, the vicar and Lord Cheam and whatever. One thing that always makes me laugh is whenever they have a vicar or whatever like that, all these people have got butlers. And always seem to say, I'll lay out your clothes for you, you know. I mean, and even in one episode of Hancock's Half Hour, even Sid has a bloke who I think it's last of them at Hancock's. When Sid says, Hancock, when he finds out that Hancock's got a castle, Sid said something like, we'll have to go off to Scotland. I smell pickings here. You may pack my bag, he says to his mate. You know what I mean? And it seems they've all got butlers or
lackeys,
Batmen or whatever they call them to do these. But anyway, that's just an aside. I just love those additional characters. I think the ones who are brought in that series done exceptionally well and complimented Hancock, Sid and Bill perfectly. To me, that's a perfect half-hour comedy. 10, can't fault it.
What about you, Ian Martin?
Well, what he said.
What he said. That was a short review,
I mean, I'm going to score it a 10 as well. I must admit, and it's funny because we've said this before. Before I started listening to this, I thought, I quite like this one. I wouldn't have put it towards the top, but the more I listen to it, the more you get out of it. And I think, as you say, it's the realism, the reflection of the societal changes at the time, because there was so much going on in the 50s with sort of the birth of the teenager and the birth of hamburger joints or the sort of the wimpy bars and that sort of thing, all sort of started in the 50s and the supermarkets and that. And this just really reflects everything back that was happening. And it's like a little sort of microcosm of society at the time. And I love that in this episode. And the supporting cast are absolutely brilliant. I think Fred is just perfect in the role as Fred, and his great accent and the wibble without handles is just brilliant. So yeah, it's a 10 from me. Love it.
Can I just say, you mentioned there, Martin, about the characters and that they. Hello, Monty.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
They said hello.
You mentioned the voices and stuff. I wonder if they get any direction as to how to play the character, or whether they just pick up a script and make it up. I mean, you know,
there's nothing on the script, is there?
No. I just wonder what happens behind the scenes, or they say, you know, play it this way or play it that way.
Yeah, how do you want us to play this? You can imagine them asking that question, can't you?
Yeah, if they're each given a character, sort of two characters each, they go, well, I've got these two characters, they've got to sound different.
They've got to be different.
One
of them
is all bluff and great like this.
And the other one might be all up here, you know. Yeah, I suppose there's that sort of element. Because they used to do a rehearsal of this, admittedly probably only the day that they came to record it, but they did a quick run through and...
I think for characters sort of... like a Lord Cheam, you know, if you was an actor and you was asked to play Lord Cheam, I expect everyone would do it. You'd all use the same sort of posh voice and things like that. But,
you know, a bit of a hooey Henry,
A pie stall owner of Italian heritage, you wouldn't necessarily do it in that sort of voice, would you?
No.
Comes across brilliantly.
Yeah.
We thought with that, you know, bit off of my load, didn't it?
I also forgot to mention, but I love that Bill says that he came over when he was 3 to take over a pie stall.
Yes, 3 years running a pie stall.
I read that twice, and I the way I read it was he came over at 3 so that he'd take over the pie stall
when
his father died. Yeah.
I didn't read it like that at all.
I didn't the first time, but you can read it two different ways.
I think missing a comma, maybe, in the script.
Yes.
Possibly.
Otherwise, if that was started off with a very low counter.
Yes.
Yes, too
and it was
right.
Raised as he grew up.
So I think, this one for me, it's not necessarily one of my favourites. It's one that sort of I heard later than most of the rest. It's not one I had on old cassette tape when I was a tot. So I think it's got that sort of more realism. There's a lot less plot. There's not an awful lot that happens. A lot of it's just the characters talking and relating to each other and winding each other up. It's sort of got that realism and that sort of bickering that you get in The Last Bus Home, which I think I slightly prefer to this one, for example. I think I'd give this one an 8.5. I think it's not quite my favourite, but I can appreciate a lot of the sort of, as you say, the cultural sort of references to change in the 50s and the voice actors and silliness of the episode. But I don't think it's sort of top tier for me. But yeah, I'd go 8.5. What about yourself, James?
Well, I'm going to fall firmly on the side of Martin and Tim here, and I'm going to have to go 10. I haven't listened to it for quite a long time in sort of the last couple of weeks, and I've absolutely enjoyed it so much. I think it's, again, the script is brilliant. I've only had the extended versions in the last 2 years, probably since we've been doing this podcast. And listening to the whole version is absolutely magical. And I think the writing is absolutely superb. I think the way it's acted and the way it's written, you can really see it. It's always like it's in front of you and it's happening. It's absolutely brilliant. You really paint a picture in your mind's eye of Fred. What he looks like in my mind, he's got almost like a black waistcoat on with a white, quite flamboyant shirt, I'd say. You can picture the pie store. Yeah. And on
Sam Martin dresses.
Yeah. Maybe it's because Martin's wearing that on the podcast now, but I think.
It's just saying, super... Do you think I like white, bright shirts, perhaps?
Scraping the salt off the clock. I mean, there's just so off the block, even. There's just so many lines in there. And I love the commentary on that era as well. Sort of that, is it 1959? June time it was recorded, wasn't it? So
June 59.
It must have been quite an interesting time going into 1960. And we all know how the 60s were. Well, not firsthand, obviously. But I think that birth as a teenager, like Martin said, I think it must have been quite a strange time, quite an exciting time. And it's quite interesting to see it from that sort of perspective of that sort of age group, I'd say, in terms of what people may well have been thinking. It might have reflected the mood of the country to an extent. So I think it's really, really interesting. And I loved it. 10 out of 10.
There we go. Barring my fairly arbitrary vote that I make up, that's an average of probably a mean average of about 10 points, which is 2 points more than an armful. That's about it for this week. So if you want to take it away, Tim.
Why not join the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society today? You can find us at tonyhancock.org.uk for all the information you need on how to join.
For just £13 a year, you'll have access to the members area of our website and receive 4 magazines a year by email packed with information on Tony, his shows and archive material.
Members also get a digital-only bonus pages supplement every quarter.
Or you can have full-colour printed copies posted to your door for just £16 a year in the UK, or £26 worldwide.
And we're a friendly and welcoming bunch, so please do join. We have reunion events with archive displays, guest speakers and special screenings.
Please get in touch. We love questions, conundrums and feedback. To do so is very easy. Send your emails to podcast@tonyhancock.org.uk.
Keep an eye on our X/Twitter accounts for latest news on the podcast and all things Tony Hancock. Our Twitter accounts are East Jim Ladd, Tony Hancock Appreciation Society, and Very Nearly an Armful.
In the next episode, we'll be reviewing The Student Prince from the third radio series.
For now, that's Very Nearly an Armful, so I'll say ta-ta.
It's sayonara from me.
Chickadee Snitch.
And this is GLK London closing down for a quick cough and a drag.
Right, so is it 5 portions of peas pudding all round?
Oh, a couple of salves as well, I think, Martin.
But put a bit of mustard on mine.
Long may your sugar spoon dangle from your chain.
This has been an official podcast of the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society. Unfortunately, it was not written by Alan Simpson and Ray Gordon, whoever they are. The announcer was me, Robin Sebastian, currently appearing in the saloon bar of the Hand and Racket.
Hey, Tub, guess what?
What?
Go on, have a guess. No. Come on, tell me. No. Go on. You guess.
No, I can't. Come on. Tell me.
Oh, no, that'd spoil it. Have a guess. But I don't know. Give me a clue. Ah, that'd be as good as telling you.
Oh, go on, don't be rotten. Tell me. Come on. I tell you everything I know, don't I?
Well, just have a try. Come on, just one guess.
How can I guess at something I haven't got the faintest idea about? Now, come on, tell me. You know I can't stand playing around when there's something I don't know about going around.
Well, you promise you won't tell anybody?
Yes, yes.
Word of honour?
Yes, yes, Scout's honour. Hick, hike, hock, cross me heart and hope to die.
Come on, come on, tell me.
Well, have a guess.
Tell me. Well, no, I don't think you ought to know.
Oh, my blood pressure. Do you hate people who say, guess what I know, and they won't tell you?
Well, you won't guess.
All right, then, I'll have a guess. Mrs. Biggs has got a new boyfriend.
No. Well, she has, but that's not it.
The Vickers Ernie bond has come up.
No.
Now, give up, tell me.
Have another guess.
No.
All right, then, I'm not telling you.
All right, then, I don't want to know.
You do?
No, I don't.
I'll bet you do, secretly.
No, I don't. I could not be less interested. You can keep your rotten old secret.
Well, go on. You do want to know.
Isn't he aggravating? I have no desire to know your daft secrets. They're probably stupid anyway. It's probably something that wouldn't be of the slightest interest to me. What is it? Come on. What is it? Tell me. Come on, what is it?
Well,
guess.
No, you're right. It's probably a daft secret and you wouldn't be interested.
But I am interested. Tell me.
Oh, all right, then. The town council have told Fred to move his pie stall out of the marketplace.